This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Phil Scott won't take office as Vermont's 82nd governor until the beginning of January, but he's already hard at work looking at state finances and working on the framework for a budget that he'll present to the legislature shortly after his swearing in. He's getting briefed on major state issues by outgoing Governor Peter Shumlin, and he's making his administration appointments, though he has yet to make some of the key appointments, including naming his new administration secretary. Here to talk us through what we know about the Scott transition is VPR's Bob Kinzel. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Jane.
So tick us through the boxes. Who has Phil Scott already appointed to his administration?
Well, things are going a little slow, Jane, but, you know, it's only been 2 weeks since Election Day. Somehow it feels like a lot longer.
That's
than
hard
that.
To believe, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's really something. So Governor-elect Scott has not made any appointments concerning his cabinet. So that would be the Secretary of Administration, Transportation, Human Services, Natural Resources, Education, and Agriculture. But he has made some appointments concerning his own staff. Jason Gibbs will serve as chief of staff. Gibbs has a lot of experience in state government. He was communications director for former Governor Jim Douglas. Jason Gibbs also served as Fish and Wildlife Commissioner under Douglas. This is a very important position. The chief of staff is really the gatekeeper to the governor. This person has to make decisions about the allocation of the governor's time. And it has to be someone that the governor totally trusts to make sure that the needs of the administration are priority number one. So in some ways, Jane, the most effective chief of staff is the one you never, ever hear about. They work completely behind the scenes. This is also the person that has to say to the governor, gee, I wish we had the votes to pass this bill, but we don't. It's a sort of a reality check.
So you can assume that he has a pretty good relationship then with Jason Gibbs and really trusts him?
Absolutely. No question about it. And another key appointment would be Kendall Smith, who will serve as the chief liaison between the Scott administration and the legislature. She will really be the eyes and ears of the administration inside the State House. Certainly during the course of the session, agency secretaries and commissioners will be testifying in front of many legislative committees. Kendall Smith's job is more big picture, and she'll be juggling many issues at the same time. Also, Brittany Wilson will be Secretary of Civil and Military Affairs. So what does this person do? What's the definition of that job?
Seems like everything is either a civilian or a military affair.
It does. So I found a law from 1845 that says the secretary, quote, shall record all official acts of the executive branch. In modern times, this person is also part of the governor's communications team and part of the legislative policy team. Brittany Wilson did serve as Phil Scott's campaign coordinator and was instrumental in shaping the message of the Scott campaign. And finally, Rachel Feldman will serve as the director of boards, commissions, and public service. There are dozens and dozens of positions on state boards that need to be filled. And Rachel Feldman will head up that effort. She's worked as Scott's chief of staff for the past 4 years.
And that position, the one that Rachel Feldman is taking as the director for boards, commissions, and public service, is a new position? Phil Scott has essentially created this position for Rachel Feldman?
I think that's true. There's always been someone on staff, though, to work on state boards that need to be filled. So in that case, it's really not a new position as well.
And my understanding is that Governor-elect Scott has said he will not be taking any more money for those appointed positions that are within, you know, that report to him than the previous governor has.
That's right. That's part of his overall budget message, that Vermont needs to live within its means. So he's being very careful about that.
Bob, other than Rachel Feldman, it seems that Phil Scott has tapped people who've been around in Republican politics for quite a while, either through other Republican governors like Jim Douglas or through candidates and other prominent Republicans like Doobie. So, you know, what is it a surprise at all that he's sort of going back to the old guard or at least the very well-established Republicans in Vermont?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise that he's going somewhat back, going back to perhaps Brian Doobie. You don't really see a big imprint of the Douglas campaign and the Douglas administration here outside of Jason Gibbs. And I think that Phil Scott is very sensitive about that. And these are very talented people, and these are relatively young people. I guess it's easy for me to say that. that they have a lot of experience in state government, and I don't think any of them are a big surprise at all.
I'm talking with VPR's Bob Kinzel, and we're looking at Phil Scott's transition. He is, of course, the governor-elect. He'll be taking office as Vermont's 82nd governor at the beginning of January. And we're looking at some of the decisions he's made for his administration and what he's up to right now as he prepares to take that job. Bob, as you mentioned, he has yet to name an administration secretary, and that's considered a pretty powerful job. You said that things are going a little bit slow. Any idea why some of those top positions, including administration secretary, have not been named yet?
Well, the governor-elect has been away for a couple of days. He was at a Republican Governors Association meeting in Orlando, Florida. They're also tackling the budget, and I think they just want to make sure they know what they're doing, that they really look at all the people who could be serving in the administration. I don't think they feel any great rush to come to a conclusion, but as you mentioned, the administration secretary is someone that the governor also has to trust 1,000%, very much like the chief of staff. So it is probably the most important position in state government.
So what about appointees who are already in position and who were appointed by Governor Shumlin, who are Democrats? Are there any who might be able to keep their jobs in a Scott administration?
Jane, you know the rumor mill is working overtime right now about the cabinet posts and commissioners. But I think, yes, I would be surprised if Phil Scott didn't keep some of the commissioners from the Shumlin administration. I'm not sure who they are, but I'd be very surprised if he cleaned house. And also, I think he's going to tap some lawmakers for some of these key cabinet posts. So it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic changes the work of the legislature.
Bob, just generally speaking, how does that work if you are either a legislator or a current appointee? I mean, we've had people come on Vermont Edition who are in various government positions and you know, sort of after the show, they'll talk to you and say, well, I'm hoping to keep my job. I might see you in January. I might not. Or do they lobby to keep their positions? Do they let Phil Scott know, hey, I'd really like to serve for you? Or is it really, you know, not a line of communication that's open?
Oh, I think it is a line of communication that's opening. So if I was a commissioner in the Shumlin administration, I think I would let the Scott transition team know that I'd like to serve another 2 years, that I think I'm doing a good job in a nonpartisan way. So I think that those commissioners who want to stay on are making it very clear that they'd like to.
So in addition to choosing who's going to be in his cabinet, what is Phil Scott doing this month in the lead up to Inauguration Day?
You know, the transition team is a big one, and the budget is huge. I mean, think about it. Phil Scott has 2 months to put together a budget for state government. It's not like he's had a whole year to think about this. And he's looking at the budget quite differently in terms of budget growth. You know, right now, economists for the legislature and the executive branch present their predictions for revenue growth. And if the projections are a little different, they try to arrive at a consensus number. And then a new state budget is built around this revenue projection. Phil Scott talked during the campaign. He wants to change this. He wants to build the budget based on the growth of wages of working people in the previous year. So the budget would be built on previous revenue growth for a very specific group of Vermonters and not projected growth. So this is huge. And he's got to go through the whole budget and make these decisions because he's probably looking at maybe a 2%, at most 3% increase in state spending next year. This was a huge part of his gubernatorial campaign, and he's going to stick to it. Now, some lawmakers are already raising questions about this approach. For instance, what happens if there are projections of very strong revenue growth for wealthy Vermonters? Should that money be added to the proposed budget, or should it be used perhaps to lower tax rates? So this could be a controversial issue during the session, especially if the Democrats want to increase spending on some human service programs. But I would say job one for the Scott administration right now is fill those vacancies in the cabinet, and number two, work on this budget in the next 60 days.
You can see, Bob, why it would be appealing, though, in other ways, to have a budget that's based on past growth rather than forecasts and projections, given how many times in the last 10 years we've seen a budget deficit halfway through the year or at the end of the year that the legislature has to make up in one way or another.
That's right. And I think Phil Scott feels very strongly about this. It's a little tricky to find the data that you're going to use to make this conclusion. Some of the data isn't available for a year or two, but he's going to stick to this. And I think it could be a point of contention with some legislative leaders, particularly the appropriations committees.
Bob, shifting our gaze a little bit from Phil Scott, is Governor Shumlin trying to do anything big in the last few weeks that he has, or is he really embracing his lame duck status at this point?
Well, I think he would deny that he's a lame duck, but we all know that he is. So he's working on the transition with the Scott administration and certainly making budget recommendations, trying to work with the Scott administration. I think we're also going to see the governor start to frame what he considers to be his legacy of his last 6 years in office. I think we're going to hear him talking about a strong economy since 2010, you know, a big expansion of renewable energy jobs, and that he's reduced the number of uninsured Vermonters. So I expect to hear a lot from Governor Shumlin in the next 4 or 5 weeks about the accomplishments of his administration.
Do you expect he'll talk about opiates and addressing the opiate crisis? I mean, that seems to be one of the things that he'd like to be able to hang his hat on as he leaves.
Absolutely. I think he feels very strongly about that, and he wants to make sure that waiting lines are reduced. So, I do think he'll talk about that quite a bit.
In other Montpelier news, two Democrats have been campaigning for the position of House Speaker when the legislature reconvenes, and it looks like a successor to Shap Smith has now been chosen. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. You know, the Democrats have roughly a 30-member majority in the Vermont House, so whoever wins the nomination for Speaker at the upcoming Democratic caucus is virtually assured of winning the election on the first day of the session. As you mentioned, there were two leading Democratic candidates, House Appropriations Chairwoman Mitzi Johnson and House Majority Leader Sarah Copeland-Hanzus. These two candidates have been actively campaigning in the past few weeks, meeting with all 84 House members on the Democratic caucus. And this past weekend, Copeland-Hanzus concluded that she simply didn't have the votes to win. So yesterday she withdrew from the race. That means it's very, very likely that Representative Johnson will be the next Speaker of the Vermont House. And she has a lot of experience with budget issues. She served on the Appropriations Committee for the past 10 years. And in the most recent session, she was the chairwoman of the committee. And Jane, she's got a reputation of working to build consensus on difficult issues. Many of the votes in her committee were bipartisan and also passed with unanimous votes.
All right. So we'll look forward to that. The official vote, of course, coming when the legislature reconvenes in January. VPR's Bob Kinzel, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Jane.
And we got a note from Rachel in Jamaica who says, I did not vote for Phil Scott. I'm quite a fan of Sue Minter, but I'm already so proud of Scott for standing up to Trump right off the bat. He has my attention and gratitude for being a decent Vermonter and hopefully a fine leader. Share your thoughts with us by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition. Coming up, we'll listen to an episode of VPR's new podcast, Brave Little State. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Something a little different for the show today. We are bringing you the latest episode of Brave Little State. That's a VPR podcast that investigates questions asked and voted on by listeners. Brave Little State is hosted by VPR's Alex Keefe and Angela Evansy. And in this episode, the program talks to leaders of Vermont's Abenaki tribes about the state's Native American community. We'll let Angela kick it off.
There's this really old cemetery in Brattleboro. It's up above a roundabout on Putney Road. The graves have old Vermont names like Fairbanks, Porter. It's not a very peaceful cemetery.
Well, there's the interstate right behind us.
That would be I-91. And this guy...
Give me a minute.
...is Rich Holshue.
So we're walking across this relatively flat terrace, sprinkled with gravestones.
We're here so he can show me a grave he came across recently.
Here we go. This is the stone of Colonel John Sargent.
Sargent was a military commander way back before this was the United States.
Militia commander.
He died in 1798. And his headstone says something that kind of makes you do a double take.
Who now lies in the same town he was born and is the first person born in the state of Vermont. Let that sink in. And realize what they're saying there. They're making a statement on purpose.
It's a statement that Rich Holshue wants to correct.
Indaluizi Rich, Tandai Wantastagak Utsi Sokwakik. My name is Rich. I live here in Brattleboro, Wantastagak.
That's Abenaki. You heard him speak. Rich traces his heritage to the Mi'kmaq tribe in Nova Scotia. It's part of the Wabanaki Confederacy, just like the Abenaki, who are here in Vermont. These are people who have been in our region for 12,000 years. In other words, just a few of them were born here before Colonel John Sargent.
The story is here, but it's been hidden. The Abenaki people, who were basically written out of the story, are still here.
This month on the podcast, the Abenaki in Vermont. Welcome to Brave Little State, VPR's people-powered journalism podcast. I'm Angela Evansy.
And I'm Alex Keefe. Brave Little State is a show about curiosity.
Specifically, your curiosity about Vermont, our region, and its people.
Every month, we put a handful of your questions up for a public vote. And this month, the winning question came from Bethany Latimer.
What is the status of the Abenaki Native Americans in Vermont today?
We brought Bethany's question straight to some of the people who can answer it best.
Welcome.
What made me curious about this more than anything else was how little I have heard in the last 35 years, which is how long I've lived in Vermont, about them.
Bethany Latimer asked her question about Vermont's Abenaki because they're pretty much a total mystery to her. She said she heard a radio story once about how their language is disappearing. She has some basic understanding of how colonization went. But on the whole, she has no good way of even, like, placing the Abenaki in modern-day Vermont.
Well, it's as though they were ghosts, and I have no way to see who they are. I mean, I may be rubbing shoulders with them every day and not know it.
And there's another problem.
My children never learned about them in school.
Bethany is a former educator, and this lack of knowledge upsets her.
I think it's a shame. I think it's in some way wrong. I think that, you know, it's the sort of thing that we owe it to ourselves to know about.
Bethany wasn't able to help report this story, but I figured the best way to start on her question was to ask it, that exact same question, to every Abenaki Vermonter I talked with. The whole idea of this episode is to answer this huge question, right? Like, what is the status of the Abenaki in Vermont? If somebody came up to you and asked you that, what's your one or two sentence answer?
I don't even know.
We're here.
Yeah, that's it. We're here.
We've been here forever.
Really, people need to know that we're here and not speak of us in a past tense or, yeah, you know, remember those Abenaki? I mean, we're still here.
For the most part, they haven't gone anywhere, so they're still here.
We're still here. And we've always been here. If you're like Bethany and you know basically nothing about this subject, you might feel like, okay, the Abenaki are still here. Why is that such a big deal? And there are basically two big reasons. The first goes all the way back to the days of colonization when Colonel John Sargent's people came on the scene.
I call it the Great Puritan Lie.
This is Chief Roger Longtoshian of the Elnew Abenaki.
Basically, the Puritans came in, wanted more land north of Massachusetts, went over to the king, and he said, well, what about my loyal native subjects? And they just like, oh, well, nobody really lives there. They just come down here and hunt and fish and then like seem to go away at night or something.
Flat out denial that there was a permanent Native American presence in this region. This went on until really recently. Like in 2002, the Vermont Attorney General's office said that the Abenaki didn't have a continuous presence in Vermont because at one point they all migrated north to Canada. Here's Eugene Rich, the co-chair of the Missisquoi Abenaki Tribal Council.
There's never been a time when this tribe wasn't here. There is a time period which we weren't talked about, we didn't talk about ourselves, and people forget.
What Eugene just said alludes to the second reason that it's a big deal that the Abenaki are still here. Because starting in the 1930s, they were targeted by Vermont's eugenics program. This was a very dark chapter in Vermont's history. It involved coerced sterilization of the Abenaki, also French Canadians, poor people, disabled people. The sterilizations plateaued around World War II, but by some accounts, they went on for much longer. Don Stevens is the chief of the Nulhegan Band of the Koosook Abenaki Nation, and he says what happened is still impacting the Abenaki psyche.
I mean, my grandmother was on the survey. She changed her name 3 times. She was born as Lillian May, married as Pauline, and died as Delia because she was trying to avert the survey. And that was, she died in the 90s. I mean, you know, it's not that far away. So there's still a lot of people that don't want to be on a list, if you know what I mean.
So for centuries, there was denial of the Abenakis' presence, and then persecution with eugenics. And then, about 5 years ago, a change. It came in the form of something called state recognition. There was drumming at the state house to celebrate when the Vermont legislature and Governor Peter Shumlin said, "Yep, you're a tribe, and we acknowledge that you actually have been here all along." This happened in 2011 and 2012. One of the tribes to get recognition was the Kawasak Traditional Band of the Coos Abenaki Nation.
It was a hard process. It was a long process.
Shirley Hook and her daughter Amy Hook-Tarian are members of the Council of Chiefs.
We're here. You know, we've been here forever, and they just recognized us. I mean...
Yeah, because people kept saying that there were no natives in Vermont and everything like that. And then finally it was like, ta-da, yeah, there are.
And I'm honored to sign into law the official recognition of your tribes that you have fought and sought for so long. Congratulations.
By 2012, a total of 4 tribes had state recognition. So to get an answer to our question about the status of the Abenaki today, I talked to tribal leaders about how things have been going since.
Thanks for having me.
The first person I met was Chief Roger Long Toshian of the Elnu Abenaki. The Elnu are the smallest tribe, about 60 members. Roger lives in southern Vermont, in the town of Jamaica, with his wife Linda and their 2 dogs.
This is my high-tech dog.
I show up in the late morning, and Roger has a big pot of mushroom tea going on the stove.
Do you drink chaga?
No.
It's a tea made from a fungus that grows on the white and yellow birch trees that we collect. It's also known as tender fungus.
Linda is also cooking a massive Italian meatloaf. And it's clear she is a culinary force.
This house is very tiny, and we've had, I counted, 24 people for dinner in this house.
Their house is tiny, and Linda barely has to get up from the kitchen table to get some of the crafts she's working on.
So these are different colors that I did.
She shows me dyed porcupine quills that she made from a whole porcupine.
It took me like 10 hours to dye it, cut it, pluck it.
The barbs are a little dangerous.
Linda also does twining and works with wampum, which are beads made from clamshells, and Roger makes stuff too. But they don't have much on hand because they've sold it all at powwows and historical events.
It's something that I do because it's part of my history, but it's also something that I love to do.
The sale of native crafts was actually one of the main things to change when the Abenaki got state recognition. And of all the tribal leaders I talked to, Roger thought this was the biggest deal.
Before we had state recognition, whenever we made something, a pipe, a wampum bracelet, whatever, and we sold it, we had to say that we were of Abenaki descent. We couldn't say that we were Abenaki from such and such a tribe. All right? That's a federal law. So you could get hit with a $250,000 fine per item. So that's why having that recognition counts.
As for more informal recognition from folks in his part of the state, Roger says there isn't much.
Down here, there's a lot of people that are aware more so of the history, but they don't know that there's actually a tribe here in southern Vermont.
In Roger's case, part of that has to do with the fact that he looks pretty white.
The average Vermonter, because I'm so light-skinned, other than if I take off my hat and they see my hairstyle, the shaved head, maybe they'll notice the tattoos, which are traditional tattoos and stuff. Most of them just look at me as being Caucasian.
So there are definitely times when Roger has to remind people, we're still here.
There's just a little short story. Me and Mike Plant, we call him Frog. We had gone to a medieval thing,
And so we had all sorts of Viking shields and swords and spears and all sorts of things like that.
After this medieval reenactment thing, they went to the movies in Bellows Falls to see a late showing. And on the way home,
a state trooper pulls us over. Most likely figured we'd just come out of the bar, not realizing that, you know, we'd just come out of the movie. So we were as sober as church mice.
Roger says the trooper is looking for something to get them on.
I had a medicine bag hanging off of the mirror. He says, you can't have things hanging down up there. He says, what is that? I says, that's a medicine bag. And he looks at us kind of like, So he looked at my license, and of course my head's all shaved. Frog now, Frog has more of the stereotypical Indian look. And he goes and he comes and he looks at us and he's like, you guys real Indians? We're like, yeah. And so, you know, we started explaining what it was, and I gather we said enough to him that he didn't want to hear anymore. So he's like, okay, I believe you.
There might not be a ton of awareness, but Roger says he feels good about the work his and other tribes are doing to build unity and connect with the larger Native community. And he says things are much more open than they used to be, even in the generation just before his.
Him and my Uncle Jackie, my cousin Vera's dad, for years and years, man, anytime you'd do anything that was Native, you know, yeah, when I was in my late teens, I had my head shaved and my ears pierced and things like that because I was an Indian. God, he was just gave me so much grief. I had to go get my driver's license, things like that and stuff. He's like, oh, they won't give it to you because they'll know you're an Indian and all this other stuff. So, yeah, I mean, even in his age, he was still worried about it. I don't think it is so much now. Now he's in his 70s and, you know, it's like he's seeing all the stuff that we're doing and that people ain't giving us a hassle about it.
But Roger says this isn't something he takes for granted.
Things can change. It all depends on who's running the world. I don't think that we're going to be completely extinguished again or you know, or have the eugenics come back, but you can never tell. So never say never.
You're listening to Brave Little State. It's a podcast from VPR that explores questions generated by Vermonters. Coming up after the break, more on Vermont's Native American heritage and how Abnaki leaders think that heritage can be made more present and visible for all Vermonters. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're listening to the latest episode of VPR's podcast, Brave Little State. This episode explores the current status of Vermont's Abenaki community. As we rejoin, host Angela Evansy is visiting the home of Abenaki leader Shirley Hook.
Would you like to see the canning rooms?
Yeah.
It's a disaster.
Shirley is one of the co-chiefs of the Kawasek of the Coas, and her basement is full of enough pickled and canned veggies to weather the next Irene.
I got relishes like jalapeno, green tomato, shell beans, kidney beans, and all sorts of pickles down there.
Shirley is such a prolific gardener that she has two gardens at her home in West Braintree.
And that's from just this year.
One is for growing the food that she eats in cans, and the other is for seeds.
So this is the native garden. We grew, I think it was like 9 types of beans.
These Abenaki crops are for a program called Seeds of Renewal.
It's just to preserve them and to have them for further generations.
Selflessness like this is basically Shirley's MO. She's helping raise money to restore the West Braintree Town Hall, and she also works with an organization called Hope on the Rise. It teaches women who are cancer survivors how to fly fish.
Yeah, Mom's always been definitely into making sure we do a lot of fundraising and everything like that.
This is Amy, Shirley's daughter. She's also a co-chief. After 9/11, when she was in elementary school, she worked with Fred Tuttle to raise money for New York police officers and firefighters. They got their picture taken at the Tunbridge Fairgrounds, and it ended up in People magazine.
So we bought like a dozen copies, of course. And
we got one over the door, and the picture of it.
Shirley and Amy spent a lot of time talking about this profound sense of belonging that they have with their tribe and their heritage, especially Shirley, who spent 17 years researching her genealogy to confirm her native roots.
It was like, wow, I belong. I think that's the thing, I belong.
And it's great that we all can say that we're something different, but you always want to know what you are and where you come from, you know, because it's nice to have a place to fit.
Yeah, that's it. That's the whole thing right there. I just want to belong to something.
Yeah.
Not a club or something like that. I just want a family.
There's a pride that comes with this sense of belonging. But Amy says you can't always be super public about it. Do you feel like Vermonters who aren't Native have an awareness of Native history? And is it something that you sort of like openly talk about and share?
Like, do we open up and share that we're Native? Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes,
sometimes it's hard. Yeah. A lot of people think of Natives as being like in the John Wayne films and darker skin, darker hair and everything like that. And there's always this sense of people wanting you to prove it. I've been asked a couple of times by people my age to show them my card, which is awesome. People have told me that I'm too white to be Native, which is cool. That part's hard just because, you know, you want to be like, yeah, you know, and but some people just suck.
Have you figured out a good way to respond to that?
No, I just look dumbfounded every time. I know it sounds pretty lame because it's like privileged little white girl saying all these things, and you know, yes, I do. I'm very pale, and maybe I have had more privileges than other people, but it just sucks that people question.
Shirley Hook says one way to deal with this ignorance is to prevent it by teaching about the Abenaki in Vermont schools. This is something almost everyone I talked to brought up. And it's true that there's no mandate from the Vermont Agency of Education when it comes to Abenaki curriculum. The agency leaves it up to the districts to decide if and how they teach it.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Come on in.
This really bothers Chief Don Stevens of the Nulhegan Band of the Kusuk Abenaki Nation. Chief Stevens lives on a quiet street in Shelburne. When I arrived, he started apologizing for what a mess his house was. His wife was preparing a photo show with pictures from her world travels.
She's been to Africa, and she just got back from Peru.
By day, Chief Stevens manages IT for the Counseling Service of Addison County in Middlebury. He conducts tribal business whenever he has a spare moment.
It's not a paid position, being chief, right? You do it because it's your heritage. So you do a lot of things off hours, like I'm doing with you right now, or on the weekends. And, of course, my wife always tries to remind me, hey, you know, there's a balance.
I feel like I got to a first-name basis with a lot of people for this story, but not Chief Stevens. Talking to this man is like interviewing a high-powered politician.
Really, we need two things. We need a museum or a place where people can go and get to know about who we are.
Chief Stevens' list actually has more than two things on it. In addition to a museum, he wants the Abenaki to have representation in the state so they can be part of things like Lake Champlain cleanup. He says the Commission on Native American Affairs should have funding so it can get more done, and he wants Abenaki history taught in Vermont schools.
Not just during Thanksgiving time. And we want people to be, like, it could be their neighbor or their schoolmate that's sitting right next to them that could be Abenaki and they would never even know it.
One thing Chief Stevens doesn't get political about is Native identity.
Well, I don't need a card to tell me who I am. You know, a Native card is just a legal thing to be able to sell arts and crafts and, you know, being Native is in my heart, and that's what I tell everybody.
The most lit up and animated Chief Stevens gets is when he talks about the Nulhegan tribal land in Barton.
You can grab the soil and smell it and know that your ancestors walked on it.
It's 68 acres. They use it for maple sugaring and growing Abenaki crops.
And it gives you that home. You know how sometimes you may come, say if you come from an old Vermont farm and your grandfather and your grandmother and his father lived there, and even if it may be sold, you always go by that place and say, that was ours. So it gives us a huge sense of pride, even though it's small.
Pride features pretty prominently in the future that Abenaki leaders are trying to create for their kids. It's a new generation, that much further removed from the dismissal and the stigmatism. And it feels like kind of a turning point.
If we were going to sum up the state of where things are with the Abenakis right now, I would say change.
Again, here's Eugene Rich, the co-chair of the Missisquoi Abenaki Tribal Council, based in Swanton.
I think we're trying to change our public persona.
The tribe is doing more community events, like holiday meals, taekwondo lessons. They're also the only tribe really pushing for federal recognition. This is a big step up from state recognition, with more opportunities for funding and other benefits.
I think there's going to be a brighter future for our children, you know.
This is Chief Lawrence Lampman. He goes by Moose. And both he and Eugene talked about how important it is for kids to see the Abenaki flag displayed in their home state. And that makes sense, right? Because a flag is a very literal symbol of pride.
A couple years ago, MBU, Missisquoi Valley, they raised their flag up on their flagpole. You know, it's just things like that that, you know, it gives these children pride.
Eugene told a story about going to his daughter's graduation last June from Johnson State.
They had a lot of flags hanging from the ceiling.
The program said the flags were from every country, state, and tribe represented in the graduating class.
And as I'm sitting there, I'm looking and looking, and there was no Abenaki flag.
So he went back to his tribal council, and they packed up a flag to send to Johnson State for next year.
Here you go. Next time you have one of our kids that graduates, you know, maybe recognize that with this flag. So again, it's just positive recognition and giving our kids a sense of pride. Because my daughter would have enjoyed that.
And of course, there's no better way to groom the next generation than with some song and dance. 3 times a week, the Title VII Indian Education Program in Swanton turns a basement space into an Abenaki drum circle. It's called Circle of Courage.
Our teacher picks certain type of people to go up in the drum first or second or last. And we do certain type of songs like the candy dance and hunting and all sorts of ones.
When we tap our feet at the circle, we can't have our hands in the pockets because they didn't have pockets.
That was Lana and Jasmine. Lily shares a key drumming technique.
It's really fun, but we have to only use our wrists and not our arms.
Remember, just your wrist. You're wasting a lot of energy just using the whole arm.
Brenda Gagne has been running the program for 22 years. She clearly loves it, though her teaching style verges on the militant.
Jasmine, you're going to start it. Where should you be? Lily, you're going to end it. Where should you be?
Our culture is very serious in teaching it because we don't want it to be lost.
Brenda's also doing her part to keep the Abenaki language alive by teaching the kids basic vocab.
Hello, friend is Kwe Kwe Mandoba. Budup is whale. Miko is squirrel. Malsum is wolf. And Azaban is raccoon.
That was Jasmine again, and also Colby. And talking to all these kids, it becomes abundantly clear that the Abenaki are still here. And then some.
That story came from Brave Little State. It's a VPR podcast hosted and produced by Angela Evansy and Alex Keefe. They investigate questions that are initiated by Vermonters. Often the person who asks the question gets to go out with the reporters and do some reporting on the story. To check out other episodes and submit your own question about Vermont, visit bravelittlestate.org and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. The show's theme music is by Ty Gibbons. Other music in this segment was by Poddington Bear and Blue Dot Sessions. Brave Little State is a production of Vermont Public Radio and is made possible in part by the VPR Journalism Fund. And that's it for our show today. Vermont law requires towns to consider school district consolidation, and some are doing it willingly. They say their students are going to have more options under a consolidated district, and they hope to save money. But other towns and some parents worry that district consolidation will effectively disenfranchise their communities and limit their path to a good education. We'll talk about where things stand with consolidation under Act 46 tomorrow at noon, and you can tell us what's happening where you live. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Our show is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.